Welcome to everyone to the second in a series of discussions on this platform on MAID, Medical Assistance in Dying. I am Dr. Michael Gord. I'm a geriatric specialist. I've been involved with Health Plexus and the Journal for Clinical Care, and I've been involved with a number of podcasts that some of you have seen, two on palliative care, one on MAID, and many other subjects. This particular podcast was stimulated by a webinar that I attended on the release of a new book to be added to the growing library on MAID and its understanding to help physicians and potential participants understand what medical assistance in dying is all about. So today we're fortunate enough to have a guest who is actually the author of a book that recently came out entitled The Many Faces of MAID. And I heard a presentation of it and I was impressed and I thought it would be of interest to the participants and physicians in particular who subscribers to Health Plexus. Most of you know that medical assistance in dying is what Canada calls physician-assisted suicide. It became legal, if I'm not mistaken, in 2016. I might be off by the date, by a year or two, but I believe it's 2016. And it's undergone a number of iterations and modifications over the years to become what many think is more inclusive. And yet there are areas that some feel, like myself, that it hasn't gone far enough. And then, of course, there are others who feel it's gone too far, and it's still a work in progress. Medical assistance in dying has existed in a number of European countries for a period of time longer than Canada, such as the Netherlands and Belgium. In the United States, it's taken on a slightly different format. It's available in a number of states, not all states, although there are more states applying for it. But in the United States, the format is if a person is approved using similar criteria as we have in Canada, the only method of undertaking MAID is for the physician to write a prescription for medications that the person has to take on their own. They could have people tending to them, but they're not getting an intravenous injection of medications, which is the process usually used in Canada. So I'm going to introduce Cynthia Clark. And Cynthia, I would like you to give to the participants a little bit about yourself and why you decided to write this book.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you for the invitation to speak with you today. So my name is Cynthia. I have a background in business administration, actually, in oil and gas. I'm not a physician or a healthcare professional. But I was introduced to the world of MAID when my husband was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, glioblastoma, 5 years ago, and who faced sort of how we were going to navigate his, I don't want to use the word treatment, but deciding how much longer he wanted to live for. He was basically told, you know, treatment will help give you a little more time, but it's not a curable disease. We had to think about how we wanted the last months of his life to look for himself, for me, for the children, most importantly. So he was really clear from the beginning, and I agreed with him, that he wanted to try the standard course of treatment and have a little bit more time, but he didn't want any heroic measures or clinical trials. He didn't want his whole life to become about treatment. And I supported that. We had lived abroad and we kind of were fairly well opinionated, I guess, in the concept of medically assisted death. And we knew that it was legal in Canada. It was quite new, just a few years legal in Canada at that time. So we went through the process of him having treatment and having to decide when it was time to apply for MAID and to go through the application process. And then ultimately he did have a medically assisted death. It was probably 2 years after his death that I started to have a little bit of time on my hands to think about giving back in some way, to think about the experience that we'd been through and how it had impacted us and how maybe more information available, specifically more support being available for caregivers, loved ones, family members would be really helpful for other people like me facing a similar situation. So I paired up with another woman who had this idea that helping people who had been through Made with a Loved One express themselves in the written form might be useful and helpful for them to process their experience, but it would also give us information or stories to share with a larger audience and to help build empathy, compassion, understanding about what that experience is like for others. So we set out on this project to compile, I guess, a book of stories, but they're really snippets of different people's experiences. And the format we chose was to go through the MADE process chronologically, but at the same time identifying and validating all the different emotions that a caregiver might feel along the way. So that was a process that we undertook, took us about, I don't know, a year and a half maybe, working with, well, myself, my co-author, and 15 writing participants, kind of did writing workshops, and we produced this book, The Many Faces of MADE, that we gave the book to an organization called MADE Family Support Society, who offers peer support to family members and loved ones who are going through or have been through a medically assisted death with someone. And the organization published the book. So the book raises funds for this organization that helps provide peer support to people who need to talk to someone about what it's like.
So at this point, would you just give a little snippet of one of the narrative chapters?
Sure. So like I said, the book is laid out chronologically. So you have a chapter that is about sort of when your loved one gets diagnosed, and then when your loved one learns that MADE exists as an option, going through the process of getting approved for MADE. And then the chapter I'm going to read to you from is when you say goodbye to your loved one. And then the subsequent chapters would be the day of MADE, and then what happens after MADE, finding support and moving forward. So I'd write here about the feeling of love. And my husband's love for me and for our kids was evident in every decision he made. From the moment he was diagnosed with brain cancer, his singular focus was on living well while he could. He wanted a good time, not the most time, and threw himself into living his last year well, with and for our young children and myself. His most important words to me shortly after his devastating diagnosis were, "Don't waste too much time being sad for me. You're too young and too wonderful to not share your life with someone. Promise me you will find happiness again." My husband, who had been too scared of the doctor's office to get a vasectomy, braved an awake craniotomy and daily trips to the radiation center to give us time with him to say goodbye. He spent the week between diagnosis and surgery building a master file of every login and password he could think of so I would be able to manage our affairs. While on chemo, he rationed his daily energy to be awake and available to cuddle our kids to sleep at night. He put his fierce independence aside and learned to accept help from friends and strangers alike so the kids could keep participating in their activities. He attended their soccer games and Christmas concerts with 24 staples in his skull and in a wheelchair at times, and held his head high and proud, beaming his best half smile from the front row. He swallowed his pride and agreed to me hiring a babysitter for the kids and him, so I could have a break from caregiving when he wasn't well enough to be the only adult at home. He let me bring a helper on our family vacation so we could all enjoy one another's company. He decided to die and not pursue alternative treatments or clinical trials because he wanted our kids to remember him well. He wanted us to hurry up and get on with living the rest of our lives. He wanted us to be happy, even though he wouldn't be around to see us living happily. My husband didn't think dying at home would be a great idea, but he agreed to it when I told him I thought it would be better for our kids. He beamed with gratitude when he saw the beautiful space we created in our guest bedroom for him to die comfortably, surrounded by happy memories and the kids' artwork. He told our children that he loved them, and he let them see his tears as they said goodbye. "You are the best daddy ever. I will miss your cuddles. You are so smart and hardworking. I will never forget you, and I will miss you." I held my husband in my arms as he died, knowing that his love for us was fierce and steadfast. I felt him drift off to sleep, his head resting on my shoulder. He had done every single thing possible to make sure we knew how loved we were. I heard his breathing change and then stop as life slipped out of his body. But his love remained. It's in the memories we carry with us, the lessons he taught us, and his love is infused in the spirit of the beautiful children we made together.
Well, that's a very, very powerful, poignant, beautifully written piece. And now that I've, it's the same one you did the other day, right? That I heard?
I can't remember.
Yeah, but that, it sounds familiar. Anyway, I think the important thing for those who are participating in this is to understand that although from the people who make policy, you know, made is a policy. You make a decision about a policy. But for those who participate, either as people receiving MAID or family members or healthcare providers, it's a very personal undertaking. And people have all kinds of opinions about it. And I've heard people arguing back and forth about the ethics of it and the morals. And I mean, the extremes of that, it's the equivalent of murder. And others saying it's the fact that we don't make it available to more people is really a shame. And that's an evolution. But I think the important thing is, since this book came out, how long has it been? A couple of months?
In September.
Oh, so it's all right. So what has been your feedback? I'm assuming that you've heard from readers.
Yeah, so we've heard from a lot of readers. Kind of the feedback falls into a few categories, but it's all been positive. People who have been through MAID with a loved one who found out about the book later and said, this is what I wish I'd had at the time I was going through it. People who are lucky enough to find out about it when they need it, when they're going through MAID, and feel like this is kind of the support group almost that I needed. It validates everything I'm feeling, from the good, the bad, the ugly, the difficult, the expected, but also the unexpected things that are hard to admit that you feel. And I think some of the most, I mean, that feedback means the world to me. That's why we wrote the book. But there's another group of people who have read the book who have not been through MAID and are not currently touched by MAID in their own lives. But one woman in particular who reached out to say, I used to have a really, I have an opinion about MAID. And I read your book because someone recommended it to me. And I came to realize just how personal of a journey that this is and how it's much more nuanced and different than what I imagined when I was just discussing it. And I've come to realize that it's just not really my place to have an opinion about, because there's a lot of different perspectives here that I never considered. And that, you know, I wish more people were exposed and to the intimate moments that you go through, because it really, you know, there were moments I hated the very doctors who were going to help my husband. And that doesn't, if that's just true, there were moments I loved them and was grateful to them. There were moments that I felt like I wish that this wasn't going to happen, but there were also moments I felt relief that this was an option. So, you know, the whole, it's very hard to go through it while you also see the arguments playing out in the political landscape, because you're scared to acknowledge any kind of like negative or emotion that might fuel the fire of this is bad. That no, I mean, this is a holistic process where lots of different things will emerge, and we're not really able to support people going through it if we can't recognize that lots of things will happen, lots of things will come up for you. And I think that's really important, because after people who choose MAID die, we still have the impact of their death and the experience of their death left in the world with their loved ones who are kind of on the side of this whole experience.
Yeah, no, I think what you say is very, very important. And I mean, I've been through a lot of situations over my many years of practice, obviously for many years before they was made. Because I studied overseas, I was able to visit, like I spent time in the Netherlands, and I spoke to one of the directors of the MAID program, who was one of the initiators, and I heard and I interviewed people. But also my own experience, as I witnessed the period before there was MAID, And even since it was made, where for some reason or other, it wasn't offered. And I just, I have a colleague who lives overseas. I won't mention where because it's not fair. Overseas, and he spent a year with me at Baycrest. And he's a very fine family doctor, and he's a writer. And he lives in a country that doesn't allow medical assistance in dying of any sort. It has palliative care, but it doesn't have medical assistance in dying. And he wrote a very beautiful article, which he wanted my views on. And then he asked if I would help edit it, which I said, of course, about a patient of his that he had for many years who had a long, long history of mental illness, depression, serious. And he helped her along with it. And then she developed a malignancy, but it wasn't serious. And, you know, they offered her various chemotherapy. And she wasn't very keen for the reasons you mentioned, because of the side effects. A lot of people do not tolerate chemotherapy. But he was arranging for her to speak to people about, you know, how to manage chemotherapy without a side effect. And she seemed very depressed, and he offered her, you know, the usual antidepressant medication therapy. And then one day, I can't remember if it was a son, called him and said she just committed suicide. Now, it was tragic because, one, he was very, very, he's a very, very devoted physician. He felt that perhaps he didn't do something enough. But when I heard the story, I thought, had a person like that been in a jurisdiction like Canada or the Netherlands, then that could have been offered as a possibility when she felt she had no more effort and energy to go through what she needed. Because it's terrible when you realize there's nothing more to do and you have to do it on your own. And I, unfortunately, in my life, I've seen many people and known people who've committed suicide. And I worked when I was a medical student, in a coroner's office in southern England. I trained in the UK. And in a month of working with a coroner, I saw at least half a dozen suicides. And they were all awful. Sometimes people think, oh, you take a bunch of pills, you go to sleep. A lot of people do very violent suicides. I mean, I have two past friends who leapt out of high-rise buildings to kill themselves.
Well, that's
and
awful.
I've seen when I work with people who blow their heads off and stuff. So to me, when I look at the whole issue of end of life, I mean, most of us want to stay alive. I mean, the absolute commitment to living is very strong. Very few people say, I've had it. Now, we know that people who are depressed sometimes say, they say, well, it's part of their illness. Well, of course. So I think that having made available gives us, for those of us who practice, a wider range. But also for the person, it gives them the opportunity to know that they don't have to do what they're worried about, they don't have to end it now.
Yeah.
Because that's very important.
I also think that, so in my situation, something unique happened, that my father was diagnosed with a life-limiting illness last year. And one of the first things he said to me when he received his diagnosis was, I want to die the way that your husband did. And something that I had, I guess, learned in our process was that we didn't realize when my husband was ill that you can apply for MAID once you're eligible. So if you have a diagnosis that's going to kill you. So with my husband, we waited kind of until he was really towards the end of his trajectory and applied when he was not doing great. And the application process and the, you know, the interviews, the assessments, it's taxing. It takes a lot of time. And then it's worrying, waiting to find out, am I approved? And so what my dad learned was, you know, he could apply while he was at the beginning, as soon as he was diagnosed, and he could still be doing treatment and he didn't have to commit to anything. But he was so relieved. Like, I saw this. It's like the sense of control had been given back to him. And he waited 6 months. He continued with treatment. And even when treatment wasn't working, he continued with comfort care and palliative care. And it was a different experience for me. I mean, my husband was very clear from the beginning, this is the moment I will be ready, and this is when I will do it. And whereas my father couldn't really articulate exactly how he'd know when he was ready, and I wasn't sure he'd ever, you know, make use of MAID, which was fine, but I saw how much it better it made him feel that it was an option that he had when he if he was ever ready. And I think that's a message that's really important for physicians to understand, is that deciding, saying you want MAID or talking about MAID or even applying for MAID isn't giving up necessarily. And it doesn't, it's not, in my opinion, appropriate to necessarily tell a patient that it's not time yet or it's too soon, because I think that is a really personal decision that most people don't even necessarily have the specific answer to. But just knowing that they have a sense, a little bit more control than they do over the things that are happening to their body and the medications that may or may not be working, is really a huge comfort to patients. And I guess the other thing I'd like to add, if I can, is on my soapbox here, is that I really wish palliative care and MAID weren't seen as such like opposite choices, because again, from a patient standpoint, you're in this time of your life where you're not necessarily doing well. You're declining, usually, even if it's slowly. And you want to be comfortable for as long as you can while you are grappling with these huge decisions and unknowns. And at the same time, trying to kind of come to grips with your reality, but more like difficultly is watching your family and your loved ones come to grips and to come to terms with your diagnosis and your trajectory. And so it's when you add to that that you have to kind of talk to two different groups of people, or that the care is not continuous, or wondering if I tell my oncologist I'm applying for MAID, will they look at me differently, or will they prioritize me differently, or will they, you know, assess my treatment differently as I'm still wanting to be treated? I think that's a really crappy situation to put a patient in, because it's not the process of thinking about it and applying for it and considering it, I think, is very healthy for it to take a long time, but not if you have to do that by yourself or without the support of your medical community.
No, I think that's actually very important. I believe that with time, certainly I know many palliative care physicians who've come to understand that for some may become a better option than what the treatments are in palliative care. I also know some who are very firm in their conviction that good palliative care obviates MAID. And I think that it's not either or. And I remember before MAID was legalized, I was very involved with palliative care at the institution I worked at. And I was asked in my role as an ethicist, which I also did, to see a patient who was in late stage need for palliative care, so more in the end of life stage of end of care. And I walked in to see him, and as soon as and they asked me to see him, because I trained in Scotland, and this man was from Scotland. He had a Scottish accent. They said, "You would be perfect because you understand Scotland." So I went in thinking I could make a connection with him. I actually brought him a cup that was given to me. I said, "I'd like to give this to you," which was written in Gaelic. It said, "Long may your lambri," which basically means "Long may your chimney burn." And I gave him a CD of Scottish songs. And he said, "Can you pull the plug on me?" in Scottish. I said, "Well, I can't do that. It's against the law." "If you can't pull the plug on me, I don't want to speak to you." You know, and I tried and I tried. Anyway, he went on for about a month, you know, with pain. He had terrible pain. And they did the best they could addressing his pain. And they're very good. I must say, the palliative care physicians that I know are fabulous in symptom management. But he didn't want it. Now, since MAID became legal, I do MAID assessments. And of the ones I've done, three of them were from a palliative care unit. And it's a palliative care unit of a hospital that I use for my own care. So I know it well, and I know the physicians well. And since the hospital knows me, I was one of the people they turned to for MAID. And each one of these people had gone through the usual stages in people with malignancies. Surgery, response, a year later, return, chemo, response. And each one had gone through the various stages, usually for a number of years. And each time, the return wasn't as good as they wanted. And finally, they said, I've had enough. And the palliative care physicians offered them palliative care. Some offered them specific treatments. You know, one of them was end-stage lung disease, chronic lung disease, 60-pack year smoking. You know, when the respirologist said, we can try this, we can try this, the person said, I have tried every puffer, but look at my face from steroids. I can't get from my chair, even to the chair, from my bed to the chair next to my bed. There's nothing left in life. I can hardly breathe between bites of food. I've had it. I'm X years old. I've said goodbye to everybody I had. So in each of these situations, they'd gone through a lot of the palliative care approaches, and the palliative care physicians who cooperated and made were ones that are very committed to palliative care, but also understand the limitations. So I agree with you. Palliative care and MAID should not be in conflict with each other, but should really be, you might say, synchronous in terms of understanding the role of each aspect. And I think it's very important that providers and family members, and certainly primary care physicians, and I now have had three people referred to me who, in a sense, expressed what your father did. I'm assuming he died, right? Your father?
Yeah, so he did. He died in November.
Yeah, so your late father.
Yeah.
And each one of them wanted advice, and that's what they sent to me, advice about whether or not they could do something to make sure that when the time came, they would be eligible for MAID, but in the meanwhile, they didn't want it. But they were told that if you wait too long, you may not be eligible, which is, in a sense, true if you really wait too long and you're no longer, I mean, if you are unconscious, you cannot give permission for MAID. And I suspect over years you'll be able to give, which you can't do in Canada yet, you can do in other countries, an advance directive for MAID, which makes sense. You say, if I get to the point that I can no longer make decisions and I have no more treatments left for me and I'm suffering and I'm not eating and I have a feeding tube, please let me go, do it through MAID. Now, that would make sense to most people, but right now you can't. So it's
although what we have now is with the introduction of the waiver of final consent, I think it's quite, it's a good bridge because you have to be eligible and coherent and apply for yourself.
That's right.
And once found eligible, you can rest assured that if you choose a date and lose capacity before your date, that your physician will still help you.
Yeah. And that's because in the process, and I have filled out the forms, you're supposed to say right up to the point that you put in the intravenous, is this what you want?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, if you're no longer capable of doing it, it would be terrible to think that you can't get it when a week ago you were capable of saying this is what you want. So I look at this as a iterative process. I've been around long enough when it wasn't possible. I remember the first cases that were reported in the literature.
When my husband died, it wasn't, the waiver didn't exist yet. And well, brain cancer, so that was a big worry for him.
Right.
Yeah.
But MAID existed. So I MAID remember existed. When it didn't. I can remember the first article I read in the New England Journal of Medicine about a physician who became very famous, that he actually admitted, knowing that he could be prosecuted for somebody who had a blood malignancy. And it was not an old person, it was a young person who'd been through, you know, everything and basically was dying. And she begged him to end it. And he admitted that he did. And it was very complicated. He went to court. Now, he wasn't actually charged at the end. I mean, he was initially investigated. So having watched the history of it, it's like many things in medicine. When you look at the history, you understand the many steps that mm-hmm. it takes to finally achieve what you think is a reasonable, humane, because that's what we all want, a humane way to die.
Also, maybe interesting for your listeners to know that you don't have to necessarily be an assessor or a provider to still sort of have a conversation with a patient that's bringing it up and to refer them to, in Alberta, it's like a centralized MAID service that does all of the coordinating and assessing and providing. But also that CAMAP, the Canadian Association of MAID Assessors and Providers, offers a free accredited curriculum to any healthcare provider or physician or nurse practitioner who wants to learn more about MAID and how it works in Canada. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to become an assessor or a provider, right? And I think that's maybe a misconception in the medical community that you don't yourself have to be an assessor or a provider to still be engaged with your patient and talking about the things that they want or don't want in their end of life choices.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because most physicians are not MAID providers.
Yeah.
Primary care physicians. Most neurologists are not. Most, you know. So those who choose to be, I mean, that's a wonderful resource that they have now, go through it and make a decision that this is one of the things they want to do in their practice. And you're certainly doing it only for, I would say, either a belief in the humanity of it, because you're certainly not doing it for the remuneration.
No. You probably make more money in palliative care keeping them alive.
You make more money flipping hamburgers if you want to do. So people do it. I know many. And we have a network in Toronto. We have a network. If there's a need, they send out a note. Is anybody available? Like, I can't travel very far for various reasons. So I do a lot of mine virtually. And virtually you can do because you get the records and you can communicate. I would prefer to be in person, but sometimes I can't. So something, I think that what you've...
Something what, that we just interject here. One of our goals as an organization is that to reach both family physicians, primary care providers, but also assessors and providers, that in that moment when someone starts talking about MAID, our hope is that they will also learn about not only our book, The Many Faces of MAID, but also this organization, MAID Family Support Society, that offers support to the people around the patient that in the journey that they're going through and making this decision.
Yeah, well, that's important. We have such organizations for every condition that we have. We have the Alzheimer's Society, the multiple sclerosis. I mean, that's one of the things we hope to do. And obviously, physicians don't organize those things necessarily, but we all participate. I mean, I'm a geriatric specialist, so I've often been asked to speak to lay people about whatever, you know, age-related diseases. I'm a writer, so I've written books like you have about MAID, about geriatrics, because the lay public nowadays, it's not that you want people to know. I mean, there was a time in my early years of training that most people didn't know anything about anything in medicine unless they were educated. It wasn't a lot in the lay literature. And physicians somehow believed, for better or for worse, that they were the repository of medical knowledge. And in some countries, and I've been, physicians still believe, and I've heard them say, what does this patient know? Are they doctors? And of course, my approach is, well, why shouldn't they know? It's all over the place. You want them to have good information, reliable. Now, sometimes that's a problem because you can find online anything you want, right? So I think this is an iterative process. I am very, very really honored to have met you. And it was just by chance, because I belong to the MAID operation in Ontario that you were speaking. And I thought your book should really be out there. And, Mark is going to make sure that when the final production of this podcast is done, there'll be a link to the book so people can find it. Obviously, it's on Amazon because it's published by Amazon. But Amazon has a huge span worldwide. And I just want to thank you very much for participating in this podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. We appreciate it. And, you know, for anyone who has read it or once you have read the book, we would also appreciate if you visit MADE Family Support Society's website. We have a survey there to kind of gather and collect feedback about how it's impacting people and where those people are located. So we would be very happy to have the feedback if people wish.
So thank you, Cynthia. And I want to thank the participants in this podcast. We hope that we're meeting your needs educationally and emotionally about many of the challenging factors in the care of the population. And if you need any further information, it will be available usually from links from the podcast. Thank you very much and goodbye.